Hello everyone, and welcome to Bookworm with me, Maurice Newman. This week I'm looking at humour, and I'm going to use examples of Irish, American and English humour to demonstrate the ways that we differ from our neighbours, and the ways in which we see ourselves, and using comedy writing as a measure, if you like, of the different ways that different groups of people, nationalities, see their own personalities rather than the stereotypes imposed on them by other nationalities. And humour's great for that. Now, I'm going to talk about the ways in which we change and evolve as nations and states and populations. The TV shows that we knew and loved in the 1960s now seem sort of dated and old-fashioned. Usually one or two stand up, and these are the standouts, the ones that stand the test of time, which I think really say the most about us as peoples. Even though humour's always changing, if a book's written 100 years ago, it could still seem funny today. And if it does, it must have had something to say about the time it was written that we can still latch on to. Something that still remains real and tangible, even though these days we spend all our time staring at screens and have the world at our fingertips. So I'm going to take this little trip through time and see if our sense of humour has improved since the non-stop laughter days of the Black Death. And accompanying us on this journey, I've got a track or an album that I've used before. It's a sampler of Blues Brothers and Soul Sisters, and there's all sorts of great stuff on it. And we're going to kick off with this one. See if you know who this is.
I hear something saying, ha, 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 ha.
Well, don't you know
that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying,
huh,
ah, huh, ah, huh, ah, huh, ah.
Well, don't you know
that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they work so hard till the sun is going down, working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away, then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. Can't you hear them saying, I'm going home one of these days. I'm going home, see my woman whom I love so dear. But meanwhile, I've got to work right here. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, my, 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 my. My work is so hard, give me water, I'm thirsty, my. My work is so hard, oh, oh, my.
It was Sam Cooke, that's who it was, the chain gang, marvellous. Right, so humour, where do you start? There's always been humour, people have always been sort of telling and jokes, writing jokes and taking the mickey out of each other since time began, really. And in fact, if we had the eyes and knowledge and experience to understand them, there are probably great jokes in the earliest cave paintings. Well, maybe not great jokes, but stuff like, you know, old Gronk looks like a monkey, or Cram Jars crap at hunting mammoths, and he's a scaredy cat, you know, that kind of thing. Later on, humour does get a little bit more sophisticated, if you like, but perhaps less funny, depending on your sense of humour. There are even people, and but there are people who think that the Bible's got some great gags in it that have just been lost or sort of watered down in translation. You can check these out if you like. It's what the internet's for, I suppose. I had a look, and I wouldn't recommend it particularly. All the jokes, and I'm making little air quotes in the air here with my fingers, are all related to bodily functions and the size of people's genitals. A bit like the old Carry On films in that respect, really. But if you come forward a few hundred years, or a millennium or so, and you get to sort of Chaucer, the Canterbury Tales, it's supposed to be deeply funny. Well, yeah, okay. Then there's all those jokes, again with the air quotes, in Shakespeare. In my experience, the only time you know when a joke's happened in a Shakespeare play is when some toffee-nosed English literature lecturer starts chortling. Like, when he's holding his sides and rocking from side to side, everybody else in the place is just looking at each other, wondering what they've missed. Well, nothing. They've missed nothing. Shakespeare's just not funny anymore. Whatever else he might be, and brilliant and all that, but he's no comedian. So I'm going to start with the 19th century. And I'm starting with Jerome K. Jerome. He's the author of Three Men in a Boat, which was published in 1887. And this is a comedy classic for a number of reasons, really. Firstly, it's about ordinary people, recognisable to us. The three young men in the boat are young lads that work in offices in the city. The clerks. Today, there'd be three young lads that work in call centres in Paddy Power or Sky or somewhere like that. They're all very keen to meet girls. I don't think that's changed much in the intervening century. They enjoy a drink, and they're all as thick as the day is long. So there's a lot of points of connection there between his audience and the current audience. And here's a little extract in which the leader of the gang is telling his chums about an experience that he had on the train with some cheese. Here's Jerome K. Jerome. I remember a friend of mine buying a couple of cheeses in Liverpool. Splendid cheeses they were, ripe and mellow, and with a 200 horsepower scent about them that might have been warranted to carry 3 miles and knock a man over at 200 yards. I was in Liverpool at the time, and my friend said that if I didn't mind, he'd get me to take them back with me to London, as he wouldn't be coming up for a day or two himself and didn't think the cheeses should be kept much longer. "Oh, with pleasure, dear boy," I replied, "with pleasure." I called for the cheeses and took them away in a cab. It was a ramshackle affair, dragged along by a knock-kneed, broken-winded somnambulist, which his owner, in a moment of enthusiasm, during conversation, referred to as a horse. I put the cheeses on the top, and we started off at a shamble that would have done credit to the swiftest steamroller ever built, and all went as merry as a funeral bell until we turned the corner. There, the wind carried a whiff from the cheeses full on to our steed. It woke him up, and with a snort of terror, he dashed off at 3 miles an hour. The wind still blew in his direction, and before we reached the end of the street, he was laying himself out at the rate of nearly 4 miles an hour, leaving cripples and stout old ladies simply nowhere. It took 2 porters as well as the driver to hold him in the station, and I don't think they would have done it even then if one of them hadn't had the presence of mind to put a handkerchief over his nose and to light a bit of brown paper. I took my ticket and marched proudly up the platform with my cheeses, the people falling back respectfully on either side. The train was crowded, and I had to get in a carriage where there were already 7 other people. One crusty old gentleman objected, but I got in notwithstanding, and, putting my cheeses on the rack, squeezed down with a pleasant smile and said it was a warm day. A few moments passed and the old gentleman began to fidget. "Very close in here," he said. "Quite oppressive," said the man next to him. And then they both began sniffing, and at the third sniff they caught it right on the chest and rose up without another word and went out. And then a stout lady got up and said it was disgraceful that a respectable married woman should be harried about in this way, and gathered up a bag and 8 parcels and went. The remaining 4 passengers sat on for a while, until a solemn-looking man in the corner, who, from his dress and general appearance, seemed to belong to the undertaker class, said it put him in mind of a dead baby, and the other 3 passengers tried to get out the door at the same time and hurt themselves. I smiled at the black gentleman and said I thought we were going to have the carriage to ourselves, and he laughed pleasantly, and said that some people made such a fuss over a little thing. But even he grew strangely depressed after we'd started, and so, when we reached Crewe, I asked him to come and have a drink. He accepted, and we forced our way into the buffet, where we yelled and stamped and waved our umbrellas for a quarter of an hour. And then a young lady came and asked us if we wanted anything. "What's yours?" I said, turning to my friend. "I'll have half a crown's worth of brandy. Neat, if you please, miss," he responded. And he went off quietly after he'd drunk it and got into another carriage, which I thought mean. There, Jerome K. Jerome, a wonderful, wonderful writer. Well worth reading the book, Three Men in a Boat. Give it a whirl, you'll love it. Very light, delicate. And just for a further flavour, it's worth remembering this quote from Jerome. I think it sums him up quite a lot. He says, "It's always the best policy to speak the truth, unless, of course, you are an exceptionally good liar." Here's Otis Redding.
These arms are mine, they are lonely, lonely and feeling blue. These arms are mine, they are yearning, yearning for more. And if you would let them hold you, oh, how grateful I will be. These arms of mine, they are burning, burning for wanting you.
Otis Redding, I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. So, Jerome K. Jerome, what's he telling us about the time that he's writing in? He's telling us that there's plenty of money knocking about right then. If young working lads can go on holiday together, they have to be earning a reasonable wage. And he also tells us in the course of the book about the morals and manners of the age. And he makes us laugh while he's doing it. But what's happening in Ireland at this time? And who do we look for, look to for comedy here at that time? Well, all I came up with was Oscar Wilde. And now, it's a tricky one, because, all right, the importance of being earnest is funny, but it's a play, and there's the Canterville Ghost, okay, funny characters, but it's a short story, not a novel. But the fact of the matter is that Oscar's a pretty serious writer. He's a funny guy, and he's a wit, and everything else that he represents in the national consciousness, but he's certainly not a comedian. He's not considered a humour writer. The portrait of Dorian Gray, or picture of Dorian Gray, is not a funny book, to be honest, and neither are many of the others, in fact. But a few years later, well, 50 years later, I suppose, we get somebody who I consider really, really captures the Irish character in rural Ireland. It's Patrick Kavanagh, and in his book Tarry Flynn, I think he sums up a lot of what's going on at that time, and the sort of the dreariness and the humour of being in rural Ireland in the 40s. Tarry Flynn's marvellous. Like the characters in Jerome's book, he's thick, But he's likeable and somewhat scatterbrained. And like all young men everywhere, he's deeply interested in girls. He's fascinated by them, but they're a complete mystery to him. And he also has to deal with some very serious issues. He's got an overbearing mother, demanding sisters, the farm's failing, and he's got Catholic guilt. And on top of all this, all the big city boys from Drogheda are coming around with their fancy dance moves. And what Kavanagh tells us here is that it was tough being rural East Coast Irish in the 1930s. Truth be told, it's probably tough for a lot of people today. But with the right writer, it's also bloody funny. Try this bit.
The mother's imagination followed her son as he cycled down the lane towards the main road. She loved that son more than any mother ever loved a son. She hardly knew why. There was something so natural about him, so real and so innocent, and which yet looked like badness. He hated being in time for Mass. He had always slept soundly through the rosary in the days when his father was alive to say that evening prayer, and he was forever reading and dreaming to himself in the fields. It was a risk to let him out alone in the horse and cart. The heart was often in her mouth that he turned the cart upside down in a gripe while he was dreaming or looking at the flowers. And then the shocking things he'd sometimes say about religion and the priest. She was very worried about all that. Not that she loved the priests. Like a true mother, she'd cut the Pope's throat for the sake of her son, but she felt the power of the priests and didn't have been able to fathom. The sun shone on the hills. Hens were flying over gates and fences to scratch in potato and turnip fields. The headlands and the hedges were so fresh and wonderful, so gay with the dawn of the world. Terry never tired looking at these ordinary things, as he tired of the Mass and of religion. In a dim way, then the place of things alive overflowed his analytical thoughts as he heard the robins and the sparrows in the hedges. A crib cart with a load of young pigs passed on its way to the market. For as well as being a church holiday, this was also a big market day in the local town. Ahead of him, at the Miskin Lane, he could see another late Mass goer whose walk he recognised, a good friend of his own, a poetic man who disliked being on time for Mass as much as Terry. This was Eusebius Cassidy, his young neighbour. Eusebius was on foot, which meant that Terry could catch up with him. "Damn nice morning," said Eusebius. "A terror," said Terry. "Well," said Eusebius with meaning. "Damn the thing to do, Eusebius," said Terry. "Be Jesus, did you see her?" "I did. She has no fella as far as I know." The two young men were talking about girls. 90% of their conversation was about girls. Only talk. Always talk. They were idealists and always very lonely. Something had gone wrong with the machinery of living, and nothing they ever planned in this line ever came to anything. They were both more than 27 in those enthusiastic years of 1935, yet neither had as much as kissed a girl. Not that kissing was much in favour in that district. Reading about lovers kissing, Terry often reflected that the fact that he had never seen anyone kissing anyone except poor old Peter Toole, who he once saw kissing a corpse in a wakehouse in the hope of getting a couple of glasses of whisky. Terry loved all nice girls. He loved virtuous girls. And that was one of the things he admired the Catholic religion for, because it kept girls virtuous until such time as he'd meet them.
Now, wasn't that lovely? That was the lovely dulcet tones of the dreaded Donny Tarrant. So thanks to Donny for reading those out for us. And now a bit more music.
I can't leave you behind.
was Carla Thomas bringing it home to you. Delightful. Right, so you've heard of a bit about the English and a bit about the Irish. What about the Americans? There's a fantastic tradition of American sort of humorous writing, and I think it can be largely said to begin with Mark Twain, although, you know, you could also say that Poe had great humour, but I don't think we remember Poe as a humorist. We remember him as a sort of surrealist, sort of horror story writer. So Twain is the beginning. And to be honest, you can't really hold a conversation about American humorist writing and omit Twain. But because I love his writing so much, it's like he's on the show every other week, and I'm always reading bits of his stuff out. So if anybody has listened to this show before, there's a good chance that they'll have heard something from Twain. So I'm going to say that we've covered 19th century USA with this mention of Twain. I'm sure there are other writers out there, but I mean, he's the big one. And I want to move forward into the 20th century with James Thurber. Thurber is a chronicler, if you like, of the middle class life in the States, and you'll have heard Thoreau's statement that the lives of all middle class men are lived in quiet desperation. Thurber illustrates this for us, but at least makes it sound funnily desperate. And he tells us about what life is like for reasonably affluent people in the USA in the 30s, 40s and 50s. And you might think it must have been pretty all right living in the richest and most exciting country in the world and earning a good wage. But Thurber lifts the lid on this sort of boiling mass of insecurities and worries that occupy the minds of most ordinary people. The normal person had to contend with keeping up appearances. They've also got to welcome or appear to welcome a large number of very strange and newfangled technological innovations, from typewriters to home refrigeration, colour television. All these things are new and wonderful, but a bit stressful, especially trying to pay for them. And these strains are part of a home life in a country that's, all right, it's at the very forefront of the world in terms of technology and economy and export and import and all the rest of it. But it still has some very, very old-fashioned ideas about morality and duty and keeping up with the Joneses. Thurber's most famous work, certainly for our generation, is probably The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. I've not taken an extract from that, though. This extract is from a collection of his short stories and think pieces, which he produced for a wide variety of magazines and newspapers. And it's about the way that we educate our children. And I think you'll find it quite amusing. What I'll do is we'll go straight from this extract into the advert break or the promo break. And then we'll come back with a bit of music and we'll chat on. But first, here we are with James Thurber. The darlings at the top of the stairs. Childhood used to end with the discovery that there is no Santa Claus. Nowadays, it too often ends when the child gets his first adult, the way Hemingway got his first rhino, with the difference that the rhino was charging Hemingway, whereas the adult is usually running from the child. This has brought about a change in the folklore and mythology of the American home, and the homes of other offspring beleaguered countries. The dark at the top of the stairs once shrouded imaginary bears that lay in wait for tiny tots. But now parents, grandparents, and other grown relatives are afraid there may be a little darling lurking in the shadows with blackjack, golf club, or 32 caliber automatic. The worried psychologists, sociologists, anthropologists, and other ologists who jump at the sound of every backfire or slam door have called our present jeopardy a child-centred culture. Every 7 seconds a baby is born in the United States, which means that we produce, every 2 hours, approximately 5 companies of infantry. I would say this amounts to a child-overwhelmed culture, but I am one of those who do not intend to surrender meekly and unconditionally. There must be a bright side to this menacing state of civilization, and if somebody will snap on his flashlight, we'll take a look around for it. More has been written about the child than about any other age of man. And it is perhaps fortunate that the literature is now so extensive a child would have to become 21 before its parents could get through half the books on how to bring it up. The trouble with the child expert is that he is so often a dedicated or desiccated expository writer and lecturer, and the tiny creative talents he attempts to cope with are beyond him. Margaret Mead, the American anthropologist, is an exception, for she realises the dangers inherent in twisting infantile creativity into the patterns of adult propriety, politeness and conformity. Let us glance at a few brief examples of creative literature in the very young, for which they have been encouraged, not admonished. The small girl critic who wrote, "This book tells me more about penguins than I wanted to know," has a technique of clarity and directness that might well be studied by the so-called mature critics of England and the United States, whose tendency in dealing with books about penguins or anything else is to write long autobiographical rambles. There was a little American girl who was asked by her teacher to write a short story about her family. She managed it in a single true and provocative sentence. "Last night, my daddy didn't come home at all." I told this to a 5-year-old Moppet and I know, and asked her if she could do as well, and she said yes, and she did. Her short story, in its entirety, went like this. "My daddy doesn't take anything with him when he goes away, except a nightie and whiskey." I am known to parents as a disruptive force, if not indeed a naughty influence, upon my small colleagues in the field of imaginative writing. When Mandy, aged 4, told me, "I want to be a ghost," her mother said quickly, "No, you don't." And I said, "Yes, she does. Let her be a ghost. Maybe she will become another W.E. Henley who wrote, 'And the world's a ghost that gleams, flickers, vanishes away.'" "Who is W.E. Henley?" the child's mother asked uneasily. "Wilhelmina Ernestine Henley," I explained, "a poet who became a ghost."
This is 90.3 Near FM.
Doors to all until our armed cross to complete.
Takeoff time is 10 o'clock on Monday nights. Join me, Tony Fitzsimons, for a musical trip around the world. Global Roots, every Monday night at 10 o'clock.
Join me, Fergus Carroll, at 10:30 every Saturday morning for the Saturday Sport Show.
The Scottish Cup fifth round, Dunfermline Athletic 2, Celtic 4, Republic of Ireland captain Robbie.
And tune in each Sunday night at 8 o'clock for the Sports Results programme.
Speaking up for a change, it's back for a second series.
Too often the people who decide on the changes in our communities aren't affected by those changes.
Arcadia's not coming in to look after the people, just for themselves.
The government says that one must retire at 65 years of age.
If it became a major concern, I think I might have no other choice.
In our new 5-part series, Speaking Up for a Change, hear older people from communities across Ireland voicing their concerns.
Our healthcare is really, I suppose, in chaos.
Putting their questions to politicians and agencies.
As part of our production, we approached a number of politicians, both local and national,
suggesting solutions.
The initiative seems to be taken again by the community, by the people who are affected.
And calling for change.
We are demanding.
The question must be asked.
An absolute disgrace.
We are advocating.
Speaking Up for a Change.
An initiative of CRAIL, the Community Radio Forum of Ireland, and the Community Foundation for Ireland.
Text 087 69 44 500.
90.3 Near FM.
New Orleans, you know I love you so. Before I be your dog, before I be your dog, before I be your dog, I get you way down here and I make you walk. Turn your lap down low, turn your lap down low. please don't go. Baby, please don't go. Baby, please don't go back to New Orleans and get your own. Before I be your dog, before I be your dog, before I be your dog, I get you wet out here, not if you want. You know your man and gone, you know your man and gone, you know your man and gone.
We're back, and that was Muddy Waters, Baby Please Don't Go. Just before the break there, we were talking about James Thurber, and we heard an extract from him. I hope you enjoyed it. There's a couple of lines in there that I just love. And now I intend to sort of chat a little bit about Flann O'Brien, and all his books are marvellous. I mean, just any, they're all excellent. Well, Flann O'Brien, it's Brian O'Nolan is the name of the writer. He just has these pseudonyms, if you like, and Flann O'Brien is one of them. And under this name, he's written The Dorky Archive and The Third Policeman. This extract we're going to listen to now is from The Dorky Archive. And I think it's got a lovely punchline. It's a very, I think, an Irish approach to a story, a long, lovely, lyrical, lilting story with just a killer punchline. So, see what you think of this one.
Mary was nudging Michael Shaughnessy. She loitered enticingly about the fringes of his mind, the deep brown eyes, the light hair, the gentleness, yet the poise. She was really a nuisance, yet never far away. He frowned and closed his fist, but intermittent muttering immediately behind him betokened that Hackett was there. How was she getting on? He asked, drawing level. That pious Mary of yours? It was by no means the first time that this handsome lout had shown his ability to divine thoughts, a nasty gift. Mind your own business, Shaughnessy said sourly. I never ask about the lady you called Asterisk Agnes. If you want to know, she's very well, thank you. They walked in, loosely clutching their damp bathing things. In the low seaward wall, there was a tiny gap which gave access to a rough downhill path towards the railway far below. There a footbridge led to a bathing place called White Rock. At this gap a man was standing, supporting himself somewhat with a hand on the wall. As Shaughnessy drew near, he saw the man was spare, tall, clean-shaven, with sparse fairish hair combed sideways across an oversized head. This poor bugger's hurt, Hackett remarked. The man's face was placid and urbane, but contorted in a slight grimace. He was wearing sandals and his right foot in the region of the big toe was covered with fresh blood. They stopped. Are you hurt, sir? Hackett asked. The man politely examined each of them in turn. I suppose I am, he replied. There are notices down there about the dangers of the sea. Usually there is far more danger on land. I bashed my right toes on a sharp little dagger of granite. I didn't see on that damned path. Perhaps we could help, Shaughnessy said. We'd be happy to assist you down to the Colza Hotel in Dalkey. We could get you a chemist there, or maybe a doctor. The man smiled slightly. That's good of you, he replied. But I'm my own doctor. Perhaps, though, you could give me a hand to get home. Well, certainly, Shaughnessy said. Do you live far, sir? Hackett asked. Just up there, the man said, pointing to the towering trees. It's a stiff climb with a cut foot. Shaughnessy had no idea that there was any house in the fastness pointed to, but almost opposite there was a tiny gate discernible in the rough railing bounding the road. So long as you're sure that there is a house there, Hackett said, brightly, we will be honoured to be of valuable succour. The merit of the house is that hardly anybody except the postman knows it's there, the other replied agreeably. They crossed the road. the two escorts lightly assisting at each elbow. Inside the gate, a narrow but smooth enough pathway fastidiously picked its way upward through tree trunks and shrubs. "Might as well introduce myself," the invalid said. "My name's De Selby." Shaughnessy gave his, adding that everybody called him Mick. He noticed that Hackett styled himself just Mr. Hackett. It seemed an attitude of polite neutrality, perhaps condescension. "This part of the country," De Selby remarked, "is surprisingly full of tinkers, goms and gobshites. Are you gentlemen skilled in the Irish language?" The non-sequitur rather took Shaughnessy aback, but not Hackett. "I know a great lot about it, sir. A beautiful tongue." "Well, the word moor means big. In front of my house, we're near it now, there's a lawn surprisingly large considering the terrain. I thought I would combine moor and lawn as a name for the house. A hybrid, of course, but what matter? I found a Ludamaran in Dalkey Village by the name of Teague McGettigan. He's the local cabman, handyman and observer of the weather. There is absolutely nothing he can't do. I asked him to paint the name on the gate and told him the words. Now wait till you see the result." The house could now be glimpsed, a low villa of timber and brick. As they drew nearer, De Selby's lawn looked big enough, but regrettably it was a sloping expanse of coarse, scruffy grass embroidered with flat weeds, and in black letters on the wooden gate was the title, "Lawn Mower." Shaughnessy and Hackett sniggered as De Selby sighed elaborately.
The Dorky Archive, a classic, a comedy classic. And if you're thinking of becoming a fan of whoever that reader was, I can tell you that it was Pat Meehan. All fan mail should be addressed to him at Near FM. So, Third Policeman. The Dorky Archive. O'Brien or Nolan, whatever you want to call him, he sort of washes in a new world of narrative comedy, if you like. But not immediately recognised, not unusual for Irish writers, of course, to not be recognised in their lifetime or in their own country. The Third Policeman was written in the 1940s, but really, I suppose, it was so far ahead of its time that it wasn't published until 1967, which is quite a long gap. And I think, I'm pretty sure he was dead, the author was dead by the time it came out, which is bloody annoying, because you don't get to spend your royalty checks on gin and cigarettes. I believe that this is this sort of long form of absurdity with the punchlines, open doors. Probably wouldn't have consciously opened the doors, but it certainly gave an idea of a new kind of voice for the next generation of stand-up comedians. And this, although we think of the sort of 70s and 80s as the first sort of era of stand-up comedians, the first, in my opinion, was a sit-down comedian, Dave Allen, who did this sort of lovely, lovely long story with a very unexpected ending. And I think it's just a carry-on from O'Brien's writing. Now, O'Brien's prose, it's unmistakably Irish. His characters couldn't live anywhere else in the world. And it's important in terms of identifying sort of national identities to be able to contrast this comedy, which is very popular in 60s Ireland, with a comedy that's popular in 60s America. They're very different countries and they have different kinds of humour and different kinds of people living in them. Although we're all seeing the same news on the TV. We're seeing people landing on the moon and we're seeing Vietnam and all the rest of it. But it's just a different reaction to all these things. And this brings me to Richard Brautigan. Richard Brautigan was an American novelist, a poet and a short story writer. And his work is all about black comedy and parody and satire. His best known novel is apparently Trout Fishing in America. But I didn't come to that one first. I came first to what is actually his first novel. It's called A Confederate General from Big Sur. And I'm going to give you an extract from this and then we'll carry on with the next bit of the show. "The first time I met Lee Mellon, the night went away with every totem drop of whiskey. When dawn came, we were down on the embarcado and it was raining. Seagulls started it all, that grey screeching, almost like banners running with the light. There was a ship going someplace. It was a Norwegian ship. Perhaps it was going back to Norway. carrying the hides of 163 cable cars as part of a world commerce deal. Ah, trade. One country exchanging goods with another country, just like in grade school. They traded a rainy spring morning in Oslo for 163 cable car hides from San Francisco. Lee Mellon looked at the sky. Sometimes when you meet people for the first time, they stare at the sky. He stared for a long time. "What?" I said, because I wanted to be his friend. "Just seagulls," he said. "That one," and pointed at a seagull. But I couldn't tell which one it was, for there were many summoning their voices to the dawn. Then he said nothing for a while. Yes, one could think of seagulls. We were awfully tired, hungover, and still drunk. One could think of seagulls. It's really a very simple thing to do. Seagulls. Past, present, and future passing almost like drums to the sky. We stopped at a little cafe and got some coffee. The coffee was brought to us by the world's ugliest waitress. I gave her an imaginary name, Thelma. I do things like that. My name is Jessie. Any attempt to describe her would be against my better judgment, but in her own way, she seemed to belong in that cafe, with steam rising like light out of our coffee. Helen of Troy would have looked out of place. "What's Helen of Troy doing in here?" some longshoreman would have asked. He wouldn't have understood. So Thelma it was for the likes of us. Lee Mellon told me that he was born in Meridian, Mississippi, and grew up in Florida, Virginia, and North Carolina. Near Asheville, he said. That's Thomas Wolfe country. Yeah, I said. Lee Mellon didn't have any southern accent. You don't have much of a southern accent, I said. That's right, Jesse. I read a lot of Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, and Kant when I was a kid, Lee Mellon said. I guess, in some strange way, that was supposed to get rid of a southern accent. Lee Mellon thought so anyway. I couldn't argue, because I have never tried a southern accent against the German philosophers. When I was 16 years old, I stole into classes at the University of Chicago and lived with two highly cultured young Negro ladies who were freshmen, Lee Mellon said. We all slept in the same bed together. It helped me get rid of my southern accent. Sounds like it might do the trick, I said, not knowing exactly what I was saying. Thelma, the world's ugliest waitress, came over and asked if we wanted some breakfast. The hot cakes were good, and the bacon and eggs were good and would fill you up. Hit the spot, Thelma said. Now, you have to acknowledge that's a very different tone to the Irish writer, isn't it? But it's, although they're not written at the same time, it's what we're reading in the two different countries at the same time, and indicates the differences. In Brautigan's work, I think you can kind of read between the lines. It acknowledges that America's in flux. It's the 60s, so everybody's taking these mind-expanding, Leclerc quotes there again, mind-expanding drugs. There's huge racial tensions, riots in Los Angeles and Chicago. Kennedy is shot. Nixon is being very peculiar all round. And all of these sort of elements and things, and many others, can be seen hovering sort of in the background of Brautigan's writing. And I think it's just fascinating that When you look back on the writing with the knowledge and the advantage of hindsight, if you like, it seems even more, what would you call it, prescient and interesting. So anyway, like many of the best writers, Brautigan was deeply depressed and an alcoholic, and he shot himself in 1984. Comedians, what can you do with them? Here's a bit of music.
Please, 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 please. Well, you
Please don't go. Mm-mm. So anyway, comedy. Vortigern shoots himself. I think we're sort of arriving at the point where I'm saying that the popular comedy writing of each age reflects what's going on in society at the time. Sum it up, if you like, a little thumbnail sketch, if you want. If we know what's making people laugh, we can kind of extrapolate from that what it is that's making them angry. And I'm going to finish up here, well, sort of mostly finish up, with The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, published in 1979. And I think it sums up the way people in England at that time felt that we'd arrived at a kind of end of history, that external threats were falling away. There'd be no more world wars, the National Health Service was in pretty good shape. The problems were little things like bureaucrats and Jobsworths. Hitchhikers is about the little annoyances that everybody goes through, and suggests that, well, because so many people are reading it, that there is nothing huge to worry about at the time. Try this. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Chapter 1. The house stood on a slight rise just on the edge of the village. It stood on its own and looked over a broad spread of West Country farmland. Not a remarkable house by any means. It was about 30 years old, squattish, squarish, made of brick, and had four windows set in the front, of a size and proportion which more or less exactly failed to please the eye. The only person for whom the house was in any way special was Arthur Dent, and that was only because it happened to be the one he lived in. He had lived in it for about 3 years, ever since he'd moved out of London, because it made him nervous and irritable. He was about 30 as well, dark-haired, and never quite at ease with himself. The thing that used to worry him most was the fact that people always used to ask him what he was looking so worried about. He worked in local radio, which he always used to tell his friends was a lot more interesting than they probably thought. It was, too. Most of his friends worked in advertising. It hadn't properly registered with Arthur that the council wanted to knock down his house and build a bypass instead. He woke up blearily, got up, wandered blearily around his room, opened a window, saw a bulldozer, found his slippers, and stomped off to the bathroom to wash. Toothpaste on the brush, so, scrub, shaving mirror pointing at the ceiling, he adjusted it. For a moment, it reflected a second bulldozer through the bathroom window. Properly adjusted, it reflected Arthur Dent's bristles. He shaved them off, washed, dried, and stomped off to the kitchen to find something pleasant to put in his mouth. Kettle, plug, fridge, milk, coffee, yawn. The word bulldozer wandered through his mind for a moment, in search of something to connect with. The bulldozer outside the kitchen window was quite a big one. He stared at it. Yellow, he thought, and stomped off back to his bedroom to get dressed. Passing the bathroom, he stopped to drink a large glass of water, and another. He began to suspect that he was hungover. Why was he hungover? Had he been drinking the night before? He supposed he must have been. He caught a glint in the shaving mirror. Yellow, he thought, and stomped onto the bedroom. He stood and thought. The pub, he thought. Oh dear, the pub. He vaguely remembered being angry. Angry about something that seemed important. He'd been telling people about it. Telling people about it at great length, he rather suspected. His clearest visual recollection was of glazed looks on other people's faces. Something about a new bypass he'd just found out about. It had been in the pipeline for months, only no one seemed to have known about it. Ridiculous. He took a swig of water. It would sort itself out, he decided. No one wanted a bypass. The council didn't have a leg to stand on. It had sort itself out. God, what a terrible hangover it had earned him, though. He looked at himself in the wardrobe mirror. He stuck out his tongue. Yellow, he thought. The word yellow wandered through his mind in search of something to connect with. 15 seconds later, he was out of the house and lying in front of a big yellow bulldozer that was advancing up his garden path. Yeah, now, isn't it funny that this sort of inconsequential, light-hearted writing, Douglas Adams style, is popular in such a brief sort of quiet period in history? And why does nobody remember much about the 70s? Because nothing much happened. We remember the ridiculous clothes, the mad hairstyles and disco. But try to forget everything else, I suppose. And it's funny that there was another brief quiet patch, a very brief one, in the 1920s between two world wars, where we had another writer of inconsequential nonsense, of course, P.G. Woodhouse. So perhaps the 1970s and the 1920s had something in common there. I suppose you can ask, do we get the writers we deserve? I had a brief look at the humour sections in some of the bookshops and some of the online booksellers, at the current list of humorist writers. And what I come up against is just an endless list of celebrity autobiographies. So everybody, all the comedians, everybody on a panel show is writing their own autobiography and throwing in jokes. Well, that's not humorous writing to me. That's just selling a bit of your sort of stage show in order to gain publicity for the next stage show that you do, or TV show. And I don't think it'll stand up. Currently, though, there is one standout at the moment, I think, anyway, and it's the Irish writer Paul Howard. And he's turning out these Ross O'Carroll Kelly books. They're about a wealthy Dublin 4 rugby-playing jock. They're always topical. They tend to follow the ups and downs. They went through the boom and then the bust and all the things in between. And he's a prolific writer. He turns out a lot of stuff, and he really seems to have this pulse on society, and he laughs at the divisions in society. And if they stand the test of time, I think there'll be a very clear picture of how Ireland is coping at this moment, like with the changeover from the end of the last century and moving into the 21st century, from bust to boom and back again. And if they're still around in 50 or 100 years, people will be talking about them as being great examples, as like great social documents. And I think that about ends it for me. It does. I have to thank my readers, two volunteer readers who the both lads who work at the station here, that's Pat Meehan and Donny Tarrant. Great work from them, and lovely bit of reading. Thanks very much. And that's it. As ever, if you want to argue or call me stupid or anything else, do so, feel free, on bookworm@near.ie. Send an email and we'll take it from there. Okay, thanks very much, and see you in a month.